Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
It's Monday, January 29th, 2024, from Peachfish Productions. It's The Gist. I'm Mike Pesca. You know, Donald Trump calls Nikki Haley bird brain. And this is not just insulting, and it is. It contradicts what we see of Nikki Haley. She's bright. She knows the issues. She's on top of things. Or so we thought, because on Meet the Press, host Kristen Welker exposed a gaping hole in Ambassador Haley's basic understanding of rudimentary current events.
If he's convicted of a felony, 42% of voters in New Hampshire and nearly a third of Iowa's GOP caucusgoers said Mr. Trump would be unfit for the presidency. Are you staying in this race in case Donald Trump is convicted of a crime, Ambassador?
I've never stayed in this race because of court cases. Really, I don't know what all the court cases are. I haven't paid attention to what he's won, what he's lost, what he's fighting for, any of that.
She doesn't know. I don't know. As if asked, hey, do you think the poodle's going to beat the rhododendron on The Masked Singer this month? Oh, I don't know. Haven't really kept up. What's that? Oh, heard about that show. I don't know if Nikki Haley knows this. This news that she doesn't know about, it's in the newspaper. It's, in fact, in all the newspapers. It's in the right-wing press. It's in the left-wing press. It's everywhere. Court cases? Oh, you talk about Night Court, the reboot? Yeah, I haven't really kept up on it. What, like, oh, a quart, like a quart of milk? Oh, no, we're dairy-free in the Haley household. Sorry, can't help you with this court thing. There's actually a playbook for answering questions like this that you might not want to answer. If you're a Trump-supporting politician, yes, get asked this on the news, you're supposed to brush it off by saying something about a rigged system. If you're feeling particularly saucy, you talk about Hunter Biden, there's a redirect. If you just want to be your regular old rock-ribbed Republican of the people, you say something like what Tim Scott said when asked about Donald Trump's $83 million defamation ruling on This Week.
Myself and all the voters that support Donald Trump supports a return to normalcy as it relates to what affects their kitchen table. The average person in our country, Martha, they're not talking about lawsuits. As a matter of fact, what I have seen, however, is that the perception that the legal system is being weaponized against Donald Trump is actually increasing his poll numbers.
And then Tim Scott added, and Hunter Biden. Yeah, that guy. But Nikki Haley, she does not have to sing from the same hymnal of ignorance. A very acceptable answer that wouldn't piss off potential voters. I don't think any honest answer would. No one who's going to vote for you anyway, who's going to be so offended that you gave any credence to the fact that this guy's facing four criminal charges, at least two and a half of them are pretty strong, is when asked, well, what about his court cases? Say, they're not good, right? Say something like, listen, without distracting ourselves from all the details of all the court cases, and some of which are stronger than others, I don't think a criminal conviction helps your average person, does it? And then you go on from there. You don't dwell, but you also don't pretend that on this issue, your IQ plunges 80 points, perhaps thus confirming the avian brainedness as alleged. Court case? Wait, what do you mean? Is a judge involved? Are there Bibles to swear on? I'm just going off on what I saw in LA Law one time. Come on, Nikki. You don't have to make a federal case out of it, but you do have to at least acknowledge at least a couple of them literally are federal cases. On the show today, I care about the plight of Native Americans, contrary to past pronouncements. Actually, I never said I didn't. It was just the stuff in the museums, but I came to care. But first, Dr. Death is a series on Peacock based on the podcast of the same name, Dr. Death, not Peacock. Each season of Dr. Death tells a different tale of a doctor who delivers death unto their patients. We are joined by the showrunner of season two, Ashley Michael Hoban, who talks about the journalism involved in this season of Dr. Death, about the Italian surgeon Paolo Macchiarini. Season 2 of Dr. Death is available now on Peacock, and showrunner Ashley Michael Hoban up next. This episode is brought to you by The Jordan Harbinger Show. You've heard me talk about The Jordan Harbinger Show because it's one of my favorites. He does in-depth interviews with some of the world's most fascinating minds. I can name a few: Barbara Boxer, Anderson Cooper, Michael McFaul, the Ukraine or Russia ambassador talking about Ukraine. One I recently listened to was Stanley McChrystal, the general, the former general, and he told an interesting story about revering Robert E. Lee. But then, after having a portrait of him for 40 years, he's a 63-year-old man, throwing it in the trash. Because his wife says, you know, what that picture and that man means to you, it doesn't mean to other people, and you have to understand that. And then in the interview, they got around to the point where McChrystal talked about that interview in Rolling Stone magazine that pretty much ended his career, where got to the desk of Barack Obama, and it had McChrystal saying unflattering things about the war effort, and just how he talked to his wife and how they decided not to be bitter and not to wallow in it. He could have taken some shots at the process, the reporter, or the president at that point, but he didn't. It was just an overall good interview. It was facilitated by Jordan's excellent interview style. Whether Jordan is conducting an interview or giving advice to a listener, you will find something useful that can apply to your own life in every single episode of The Jordan Harbinger Show. That could mean learning how to ask for advice the right way or discovering a little mindset tweak that changes how you see the world. Search for The Jordan Harbinger Show. That's H-A-R, like the first three letters, and hard, B-I-N-G-E, as in how you'll want to catch up on all the episodes on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts.
He's experimenting on people.
I want to see it with my own eyes.
My team and I have to deal with very extreme cases.
Just the ones extreme enough that nobody will notice when you kill them.
History is built on lines that we must be willing to cross.
What'd you do, Paolo?
What did you do to them?
We have to figure out a way to stop this guy.
She's sitting there with a bloody time bomb in her throat.
Clear.
Paolo Macchiarini was a surgeon who experimented with stem cells and trachea implants. He was considered to be in the possible running for a Nobel Prize in medicine. In fact, he worked for the Swedish hospital that awards the Nobel Prize. There was one problem. The trachea transplants didn't work, and almost everyone he operated on died. And he would have gotten away with it if it weren't for those meddling fellow doctors, investigative journalists, trail of dead patients. In fact, you might wonder, how did he get away with it for so long? That is all covered in the new Peacock series. It's season 2 of Dr. Death. If the phrase Dr. Death sounds familiar to you, podcast listeners, because yes, it is all based on source material from a podcast, and we're joined with the showrunner of the TV series, the Peacock series of Dr. Death, Ashley Michael Hoban. Welcome to The Gist.
Thank you for having me.
Are you a big podcast, whodunit true crime person?
I'm a big podcast person. I think the second I wake up, I don't want to be alone. So the second I wake up, I turn on podcasts. And, you know, eventually when you get through all of the new stuff and all of the wait, don't tell me, you end up with true crime. I think that's where we all inevitably end up. So yes, I can say I'm a fan.
So there is something about the about this kind of subject that is very popular with podcasts. And I have a theory as to why. It's well, first of all, there's a hook for female listeners. Second of all, it's kind of nice to have structure. Like, it's called Dr. Death. You know the doctor does it in the end. And that sort of hand-holding actually works pretty well in the podcast form. Is that as appealing in the TV serial form, where my theory is that viewers are a little more sophisticated when it comes to TV. They don't need as much hand-holding. So, but to go back to my question, do you think that it readily is as appealing to TV viewers as it apparently is to podcast listeners, where this genre of podcast is perhaps the most popular?
That's a really good question. You know, I think in the podcast form, you have the ability to sort of like step out what makes the guy so terrible. The
you know, the tricky thing about the show was that we sort of needed an audience to fall in love with him a little bit in order to understand how he got away with it for so long, or else you're not on the side of the team that's fighting against him, you know? So we need those people to be, we need audiences to be on their side and understand what they're going through. Because if you just come at the story at the end, it seems ridiculous. Like the things he told his fiance seem ridiculous and the medicine seems ridiculous. But if you, so the process of like really diving into the medicine and understanding how he was able to do that was the challenge of the show.
Right. So the way in is the audience surrogate is the journalist. And this is all true. A journalist for a news magazine show who profiled him and fell in love with him and was going to get married with him. And then if there is the question, OK, how do we make sure she is the audience surrogate and that the audience likes and identifies with her? Well, I'd say 90% of that work is done by casting Mandy Moore.
Mandy is one of those people that you just love to love. You know, she brings all of the sort of like effervescence and energy that she has on screen, she has in person. So yeah, that was an easy choice. When we found out she was interested, it was like that made, yeah, you're right. That was that took care of a lot of the work for us.
Right. And so we watch him through her eyes and he seems charming and he comes with great credentials and also his trail of successes. At this point, there's no whiff that he's doing anything wrong. And even though we know that a journalist is not supposed to fall in love with her subjects, in fact, it gets said, it's a mantra on the show, and I want to ask you about that. It happens. So from a writing, directing, show running standpoint, what are the pitfalls you have to avoid to make her falling in love believable, but also not make her seem like an obvious simp, but also make him seem evil enough that you wind up hating him?
Mm. Yeah, you know, they come together, Benita and Paulo come together at such a particularly vulnerable moment in her life. And this is, you know, this is stemming off of the true story that she was going through. There was a death happening in her life and her family, and she was kind of really desperate for some kind of avenue out of the darkness that she was feeling. And then she met this guy and it felt like, okay, there is hope. There is hope out there in the world of medicine and in life and love, and there's something there to be had. Because you're right, it's like if it's called Dr. Death, we know that something bad is going to happen.
That's right. Scene one, protests outside a clinic. You killed people. Mm-hmm. It's not as if we're hiding the ball on what this guy does.
No, there is no hiding it. And so then the kind of goal and challenge was to explain the medicine away in a way that it feels hopeful, and you start to wonder if it becomes a question of, is it on purpose? Is it nefarious? Where is the Dr. Death moniker coming from? Is it coming from a place of, you know, sociopathy, or is he misunderstood? Because in his mind, I think even to this day, if you ask him, the real Paolo Macchiarini, he's just a misunderstood doctor whose groundbreaking treatments are being rejected, you know, so.
Yeah, but there has to be such a massive amount of willful ignorance to think that that's true. He might want it to be true. He is a real surgeon. He did invent this treatment. It just never worked. And he either faked results. Would that be accurate to say faked results, or didn't properly document that it did work?
Both.
So how would he?
Things are true. Yeah, I don't think that the majority of audiences are going to come away. I hope that you come away understanding his point of view. But really, at the end of the show, he is the bad guy, and he made awful choices, and he sacrificed people consciously, you know, on what level, I don't know, but consciously in our show, where he's sacrificing people for the, you know, to further his medicine, which is a financial benefit to him and gives him the renown and the power and the influence and the money to keep going.
Right. And so my audience who hasn't seen the show or listened to the podcast understands what he was doing in a sentence is he was implanting plastic into people, and you would say, oh, they'd normally reject the plastic and die. And guess what? That's exactly what happened. But maybe he believed this part that his stem cell magic would work. I mean, stem cells are real. Maybe he convinced himself that all the results of his people dying, they would have, I mean, this is what he said to defend himself. Maybe he really believed they would have died anyway, or he had a strong, there was a strong shot of it working. But it brings me to the question, a lot of con men are so, they're interesting, we're drawn to them. But a very, very common explanation about con men is, you know, I think at some point they began to believe it. And I don't know how often that actually is true in terms of human nature. But for you, someone writing that character, I guess it's helpful if it's true or true enough.
Yeah, that's a good question. I think it's easy for us to, I think it's easier for us to wrap our minds around somebody like that if we're like, well, they believe it. You know, it's like we're humanizing them in a way that they might not always deserve. But you are right in that at least at the beginning, Paulo was, this was also coming around the time when stem cell research was going to be the miracle to everything that we haven't yet cured. And the throat and the trachea is a pretty difficult place to work medically because everything that you breathe in touches that, you know, it's filtering in all of the germs. So yes, I think there's a hope there. And I think he was kind of always looking for an adjustment. It's like, okay, it's going to work next time. And this is just, these are casualties that are sort of necessary for me. And so I don't know that we don't know what's inside of his heart and mind, but I think it might be a little bit of a cop out to say that these people really believe it in the moment, because at a certain point, you know, he was working with terminal patients and then he moved on from terminal patients, and these people were not going to die and they were going to live healthy lives forever until he put these tracheas inside of them. And at that's the point at which, you know, you sort of it loses its, the argument of he believed it loses its credibility, because it feels like then at that point they're just guinea pigs for him.
So I wanted to ask you about, I'm a journalist, mm-hmm. and the journalistic questions I perceive there is early on, Mandy Moore's character, who's based on a real life character who wrote, who's covered an interesting Vanity Fair article. You know, she got duped by this very charming guy, mm-hmm. but also with a lot of red flags. She is a journalist. He was a source. And not only do they say it as a mantra, and we could say it here, don't fuck your sources. Mm-hmm. You even put it in one of the as seen on pre-rolls. Don't fuck your sources.
Don't fuck your sources.
Yes, that's like before as seen on last episode. Don't fuck your sources. So question one, do you have a couple of F words you could say per episode via Peacock rules?
No, Peacock is limited? Open. Peacock lets us do what we want. So
very good. But was all that there? All that was there because I'm sure she in real life they had that conversation. But there's also a little bit of backlash to the many depictions of female journalists who do in fact sleep with a source. And it gets criticized a lot. When as a trope. Now, in your case, it really happened. But did you want to address that specifically? Because you know it's a trope and you didn't want to put it out there just wantonly?
Yeah, you know, I think the goal is that you watch her go through the process of falling for this guy, and you watch her make that decision, and then you watch her regret that decision, and you empathize with what she's going through instead of coming at it from a place of judgment. And, you know, and it does happen. This is such a particular, you know, they were spending so much time together and I think, you know, sleeping together and meeting each other's families and being involved in each other's lives and traveling together, their relationship became so much more than an affair that I think it sort of sets it apart from the trope in a way. And, you know, we show her, we try to show her fact checking right off the bat, because she does. She checks his stories and they check out, which is, you know, leads you to a whole nother conversation about the peer review process in medicine. But you know, with the exception of this Pope story, which is, you know, nutsy cuckoo, she did her research and it all checked out. And so it's and when you're being swept off your feet like that, I can imagine that it would be. You know, we all do this. We all date people and see red flags at the beginning and think that maybe it's going to be okay, or we can work around them, or they're just a whatever, and you ignore them. We all do that.
Do you or the network have audience research about the gender breakdown of who watches Dr. Death?
You know, I'm not. I would imagine that there is somewhere. I do not. I would imagine that. Because I know that women consume true crime at a pace that feels unhuman. I would imagine that we have a yes. female audience, but I hope it's evenly distributed. But I'm actually not sure about the breakdown.
That's probably good, and that probably is good for you in your process. But I was just wondering if any of the specifics about this show are not, I wouldn't say geared for a female audience, but might hit them. The specifics of this or season one might hit them a little differently than a male audience, or harder, do you think?
Certainly. I mean, I'm a woman, so I'm going to come at it from a different perspective than Patrick was going to come at it. You know, and part of the reason why he wanted me to take over the season was because he said, you know, that we have this love story and this woman at the helm of it, and he wanted a woman to tell that story. Yeah. You know, he didn't, you know. So yeah, of course there's always going to be, and that's the question of voices and diversity in voices, right? So we all can come at a story from, there's one story, we would all come at it from a completely different perspective.
Yeah, there's also these, you know, these male savior figures, and it, I think, plays differently for, when your love, your supposed love has betrayed you, just as he's betraying patience. It's different. Right. I think relatedly, and you talked about the pandemic, do you think that there were some moments in here that were either, well, you would know consciously or maybe even subconsciously, addressing much of what we went through of science sort of being on trial? And also maybe beyond science being on trial, science being this argued, debatable point where you can put it on a lawn sign, or you can rebut it, or you can rebut the rebuttal of the idea of trusting the science. Because that's how it landed to me. There were some scenes, especially in the last few episodes, talking, some of the doctors talk about the imperfections of science. And I wonder how informed you think that was by the big debate thrust upon us by the pandemic about science.
Well, you know, I think the moral here is what I would wish for people to take away is questioning science, but it's actually, you know, Gemelli's character, the three whistleblowers character, they're actually sticking closer to science than Paolo ever has. And I think, you know, the loopholes in the scientific process, which is not the science of, like, literally the science of it, but, you know, the process in which they're publishing papers and they're peer reviewing these papers, and that process is imperfect. And really, when you go back to the science, the actual science of it, and go back to the facts of it, and take the steps necessary, because that's the big reveal of Paolo's medicine, the magic of his medicine is that he never did any of the trials. And if you don't do the work, then you could say anything works. If you do, you know, if you don't have to prove it, then anything's possible. So the proofing of it is the science that we want to fall back upon. You know, I also don't want people to kind of like, I know that when you hear the title Dr. Death and you watch this show, it's easy to kind of like shift into the histrionics of, I will never go to the doctor again and I'll never trust the doctor again. But in fact, there are many, many more doctors in this season and last season and in the world, factually, that are working to take care of people that far outweighs the Dr. Deaths of the world.
Sure. Dr. Non-Death, Dr. Lack of Death. You don't get a show greenlit, but that's the normal course of things.
That's right.
Maybe even Dr. Life. Dr. Avoid Death.
Dr. Life. I like that. Dr. Stave Off Death.
Yeah.
That's the next
delay thing. For a little while death. Exactly. That's the unstated type of doctor most of us goes through. And finally, my last question for you, Ashley, is why is it so hard to do the right thing?
Oh, goodness gracious. You got to watch Dr. Death season two to really see. No, you know, that was a moment, I think, in the writer's room where we sort of were like, you sigh and you think back on all of the people that spoke up and all of the work that they had to keep doing to hold this guy accountable. And on both sides, you know, Benita's side, on the personal side of Paolo's life, and the whistleblowers on the medical side, we make it harder for ourselves to do the right thing. You know, we make it harder for ourselves. And the way to make it easier is to keep supporting the people that are doing the right thing. So, you know, that speaks to the sort of support of whistleblowing and the philanthropic branch of the production company that produced the show that is working really hard to sort of lay groundwork for patient advocacy and patient care. So hopefully it gets easier to do the right thing every time.
Ashley Michael Hoban is the showrunner for season 2 of Dr. Death on Peacock. Thank you so much. Great talking to you, Ashley.
This was so fun. Thank you so much. I appreciate you having me.
And now the spiel. The other day I talked about news I wasn't much interested in. People took that as news that I think is unimportant. No, I'm just saying I'm not reading any more stories about water in the West. Does it take 1.1 gallons to make an almond? So they say. I shall continue to eat almonds and perhaps worry in the back of my mind. No, in the back of your mind or whoever reads the stories about water in the West about how they're going to get all that water for all those almonds. I'm not saying it'll all work out. I'm saying there's only a certain number of things that I could actively engage with. Another item on that list was the return of relics from museums to the places that the relics originated from. Yes, I know it's going on. I've read a few stories about this. They always seem the same. I'm not going to recapitulate why I say I'm not interested in that, especially because there's an update. I am now interested in one aspect of this story, and this is the Native American Graves Protection and Repatriation Act, or NAGPRA. NAGPRA has been on the books since the 90s, but it's really begun to be enforced. In fact, all across the United States, we have signs that we will get to of museums saying we need to do the right thing now. So my take, if you have brains, if you have bones, and descendants want those brains and bones, you gotta give them back. Let's say you're a museum with an Arapaho display, and the Arapaho say, take down that display. Don't store the bones or brains of Arapaho people. There is basically no choice, nor should there be a choice, of displaying that in your museum or holding that in the basement of your institution. You must defer to the Arapaho on the point of displaying the Arapaho. And as with the Arapaho, goes every other Native group, including the descendants of slaves. It's not only ethical, it's almost the least you could do. So the Native American Graves Protection and Repatriation Act says, we're sorry, here are the remains of your people back. And that sounds simple enough, does it not? It does not. Let us go to Texas, where the University of Texas has remains that the Mekong Garza tribe says are their ancestors. But the problem is that the Mekong Garza is not a federally recognized tribe. That is a giant problem because by law, no one can give back remains to a tribe that is not federally recognized. It would be compounding the problem. KUT Radio quoted Maria Roca, an elder of the Mekong Garza tribe.
So UT is saying that spirit can wait 3 or 4 more years, 10 more years in agony, in our perspective, in agony, can wait 30 more years. So I'm saying to myself, if their parent or their grandparent was in agony, would they just postpone it for a few more years? No, no.
Well, I would say it's in the tradition of anthropologists and museums to not be in agony. They would be, these people we're talking about, would be considered dead and incapable of feeling any kind of pain. We have a couple of irreconcilable tensions here. So what's the big deal if a museum, maybe you're asking, just do the best you can. Be respectful of the Native or Indigenous communities that are asking you to be respectful. Dispose of their remains as best you can. Either give it to the people, or if you can't, have a burial. This is what the University of Pennsylvania Museum is doing. They are in possession of 20 body parts of formerly enslaved people, so they have planned a burial. But DNA testing showed that one skull had indigenous DNA, which raised the possibility that the respectful burial was in fact a violation of the Native American Graves Protection and Repatriation Act. Of course, why'd they test the skulls? Because they didn't want to make a mistake. None of this is close to the realm of acceptable to the Penn Museum's main or at least most vocal critic, Abdul Ali Muhammad. Here he was quoted by local radio station WHYY.
My body was hot. My heart was pounding. I was really enraged, really angry. at knowing this information.
Muhammad has alleged the former curator of the museum has lied about being able to prove the origins of all the remains in the collection, and she has sued him for defamation. In Cleveland, as is the case with New York's Museum of Natural History, the museum there is covering up exhibits that don't have remains, but may have funerary items, or in some cases just canoes or masks used by Native American tribes. Here's ABC Channel 5 Cleveland reading the statement put out by the museum.
Out of respect for the Native American tribes in NAGPRA, the CMA has covered the display cases that contain items that might fit the new NAGPRA definitions until the appropriate determinations can be made and, if necessary, consents obtained.
In Chicago, the Field Museum covered several display cases containing cultural items from Native communities. Quote, pending consultation with the represented communities, we have covered all cases that we believe contain cultural items that could be subject to these regulations. Well, next, I will give you a quote in the Native News Online. This is Shannon O'Loughlin of the Choctaw Nation. She's the chief executive for the Association of American Indian Affairs, and she said of the Field Museum statement, quote, if they really were wanting to get the word out that this is an important requirement that we all must follow, that's a different way of saying it than they have in their press statement. It's not a statement of protection of tribal rights. It's not put forward as a positive thing for tribes, but in this abstract, nonsensical thing. Now, I, as a non-Indigenous person, I guess I'm Indigenous somewhere, not here, as a sometimes museum goer, as a white American who recognizes the sins of the past and would like to correct them as best we can, I see it a different way. It seems to me that American museum curators are actually trying to do the right thing. They just can't throw away scholarship. They have to follow regulations, and they don't want to give remains to the wrong tribes, but they are trying. It's a lot easier to paint their efforts as an obstacle to healing, however. The Washington Post did a very long series about human remains at the Smithsonian, and the language in the newspaper, and this might just be inevitable given the subject matter, but it did seem constructed as to inevitably lead to the most anguished conclusions. Here, I'll read some. The Smithsonian would eventually acquire more than 280 brains from around the world. More than a quarter, 74 of the brains still held by the Smithsonian were from local people. According to documents reviewed by the Post, of those, 48 were black. At least 19 of the brains are described in documents as having been removed from fetuses, including one following an abortion. 17 came from children. 3 were taken from people who died in the hospital that served the city's almshouse. 1 was taken from a deaf and mute man. Now, that just seems unconscionable. You don't want to keep hearing about it. It just seems horrible. It seems like of inherently violative. What it was in reality in 1903, which was over 120 years ago, was just how things were done. The sensitivities, the practices, the general pursuit of knowledge was a lot different from today. It was not more evil. It was not more purposefully cruel in the minds of those conducting it. It was just different. The Post writes of a 21-month-old who died and whose body was used for study in the Smithsonian. They contacted a relative of the child, who died 119 years ago, and she was quoted as saying, "It feels like my family was robbed of something. A child, especially of that age, can't speak up for themselves." True, a 21-month-old can't speak up for himself, but even if he could, this is so insensitive, but the child was dead when the brain was taken. The child wasn't killed for his brain. The child was in a situation in 1903 where it was quite common to take a body or a part of a body for medical science. I realize that I, Mike Pesca, am several standard deviations removed from the average person when it comes to issues of spirituality or belief in the afterlife, but it doesn't really matter what I think. I just default to what the next of kin might think. But someone they found this relative who didn't even know the circumstances of her 21-month-old ancestor's demise. And she said this understandable thing, oh, that seems horrible. But really, 120 years later, this Washington Post series portrayed the Smithsonian as if they were all a bunch of macabre grave robbers stealing brains like Dr. Frankenstein's assistant. But what this was, even if you think that's what was going on, it was what we would call pretty close to the state of the art of scholarship at the time. This is how they studied specimens. It seems horrible to call a 21-month-old baby a specimen, but that's how it was done. And now, and this is the important thing, it's being undone. Standards of consent didn't exist like they do now. But that's the point. Now they do. I see all that's going on as progress and correcting what we now recognize correctly as a wrong. Instead, it seems more like an opening of wounds, a reminder of the ghoulishness that is more upsetting than not to the very communities being served by actual NAGPRA enforcement. I suppose to heal wounds, we have to acknowledge wounds, but it seems to me like a bit or a lot of a missed opportunity to some extent, celebrate progress or experience collective solemnity. The entire culture of today, as far as I could tell, the 2024 culture, is now in favor of doing the right thing, returning remains to their people. And isn't the positioning of the present, isn't that worth at least some measure of, I don't know, acknowledgement as we address the pain of the past? And that's it for today's show. Solo producing today was Corey Wara and his quaint mallard mate, Joel Patterson. We wish a get well soon. Michelle Pesca is in charge of special projects for Peachfish Productions. To advertise, go to advertise.com/thegist. Doom Peru, G Peru, Do Peru, and thanks for listening.